Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to DragonCast. Home of House of the Dragon.
He's afoot.
Gather your small council, send out your ravens and call in your bannermen. I'm Hand of the King, Jamie East, here to guide you through the insane world of Westeros and beyond. Wakey wakey, hands off snakey, it's another episode of your favourite DragonCast. I'm Jamie East.
And I'm Chris Mandel.
How you doing?
I'm good, yeah. I'm trying to check. Sometimes whenever you introduce me, I always get a bit spooked. I always forget how to say words. So I'm trying to, like, try a few different cadences. I listen to other podcasts and I think, oh, they're very good at saying their own name. And then when I do it, it gets...
Talk to me a bit more like James Acaster. I'll be a bit more... Hello, welcome to DragonCast. I'm James Acaster. Pop a dump top word.
That was quite a Beau Selector. It's sort of take there.
It was, wasn't it?
But it's, you know,
I love James Acaster. He's very nice.
Yeah, but yeah, it's, I think it's quite hard. Anyway, how are you?
Yeah. I'm good. Yeah, fine. I confess, my head's been in a spin over DragonCast the past few days.
What's been going on?
Well, no, just because, like, at the nature of, you know, we're on, like, it's like start of a new term, so we're on season five now.
Yeah.
But we've missed out... Episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7
episodes.
So we'll go into in a bit, and then I watched the OA episodes 3 and 4, which we're going to record at a later date, like probably tomorrow,
yeah,
or death. Because sorry again, I thought I'd bloody published. I didn't even publish last week's OA episode, so forgive me. I don't know what happens. There's just like a real perimenopausal thing going on with me at the moment.
I think it is that, yeah. I think that's what it is, yeah.
So I will, I have it all edited and good to go. I'll put that out tomorrow, which is good. But, you know, they're such crazy episodes, and the whole Thrones thing, like, normally I can pick up pretty quickly, but I must confess, like, we're going to be talking about season 5, episode 8 in this episode, which was Hard Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Which just felt like I've been thrown. Like the last thing we did was season 4, episode 10. So we've missed out on a full 7 episodes.
I think it's the longest episodes. The longest jump we've done, definitely. Yeah. And you 100%. Do. I mean, I didn't really read. I remember what happens roughly, but I was jumping into some scenes, being like, "Wait a minute,
yeah,
what's happened?"
I mean, I think what we need to do before we start with it. Even before we start talking about Hard Home, is just have a quick bullet point recap of things, mm-hmm. what have happened in season 5 up to now. Do you think that would make sense? Because I like how I introed this as if I had it planned and had all my notes ready. Not a bullet point in sight, but let's...
Yeah. Okay, it was the spoken word version of a bullet point.
Yeah. So... If we go from the top, so episode 1 was The Wars to Come, which was where obviously Tywin's death has been found, and
mm-hmm.
Tyrion and Varys arrive in Pentos.
Yeah.
Jon gets caught between between two kings here.
Yes, that's Stannis and Mance.
Stannis and Mance, that was it.
He doesn't know who to be loyal to.
Yes, you know. That's right. Yeah. There's the Marine. We meet the Sons of the Harpy for the first time. And for those that can't remember those, they're like this weird assassin group that wear those gold masks.
Yeah, they're sort of like the old school, like, they're rejecting Daenerys's sort of turning up and deciding she's in charge, I think. Yeah. Masters and former slave owners.
That's it. Stannis tries to recruit the wildlings in his war. John can't help Mance, doesn't bend the knee. So as Mance is burned alive, that's when John shoots an arrow, defying Stannis' command and putting Mance out of his misery, which is seen which was a noble thing to do. Arya arrives at the House of Black and White.
Yeah.
Meets Jaqen, and then we kind of like begin that kind of story.
That whole thing. Yeah.
That whole thing. Jaime gets Bronn to travel to Dorne to retrieve Mycela. Do we meet the Sand Snakes in this episode? We probably meet them at some point.
They're in episode two of season five, okay. Because they get sent a message from the Sand Snakes that has Mycela's pendant in the jewels of an ornate golden snake, and they think it's a threat. Yes.
That's it.
So he goes to try and get her back.
Perfect. In episode three, which we missed, Margaery has married Tommen by now, and begins that whole manipulation of Cersei, and works out how they can, you know, it's part of her. I think it was part of her plan, using the High Sparrow's Faith of the Seven to get rid of Cersei. Am I right remembering that right?
I don't remember I think my recollection of what happens is Cersei allows the High Sparrow, she kind of brings him into like King's Landing, and they have like a religious army called the High Sparrow and
Faith Militant.
So yeah. Cersei thinks this is the easiest way to, like, first of all, bolster her power, because, like, she's actually not in charge since Tywin died. She's kind of like, well, I'm the Queen Regent and Tommen's young, so, like, until he's married, I'm going to have to, like, amass some power. And I think also, like, you know, this is sort of established throughout season five, but she's not really very smart. Like, she's not a politician. So she makes all these bad decisions. She brings in the High Sparrow, who is looked quite poor and unkempt. He's got an army and this religion, and she thinks it will help get Margaery down. Cause like Margaery is, there's theories that she's sleeping about a bit, and it sort of backfires, and Cersei and Margaery get sort of implicated.
That's it. They get fucked.
Royally fucked.
That's right. John executed Slint. Do you remember Slint?
Yeah, love that. That's a really great scene.
Yeah,
just so good.
John is now Lord Commander.
Right? Yeah, they do an election, and Sam sort of encourages them all to like vote for John.
That's right. Yeah. Tyrion gets abducted by Jorah, intending to give him to my queen. So he nicks
my queen.
Tyrion as like a bargain, and so he can present a Lannister to Daenerys and try to curry favour. Loras gets arrested for being homosexual. Marjorie's enraged, but it all goes a bit wrong. Is it this one? So the Sand Snakes plot to avenge Oberyn's death by abducting Mycela. That's all a bit nothing, that episode, Sons of the Harpy. It's a bit boring.
Yeah,
isn't it? Although it ends with Ser Barristan Selmy getting killed, which is a deviation from the book, and one that made Sir Ian McElhenney, like, absolutely furious. Like,
was it really?
Yeah. He won't mind me saying that. We had him on Thronecast, I think, just after that episode. And he was deeply upset because he was a book fan, like a real big book fan.
Yeah.
So he'd read, he was like, yeah, Barristan Selmy, like, he's in it's it like for the ages. Guy. This is fucking great. He's a man. He's the hardest
Jorah's
guy.
Jorah's gone. Barristan's like the number one. And it's like, exactly. No, he gets stabbed in the street.
And then he gets stabbed in the street by a fucking Sons of the Harpy, critically wounding Grey Worm, and you know, that's the end of it. He wasn't best pleased at all. Then we have the Kill the Boy, which was I think centered around centered around Arya, but it's not. It's Brienne and Podrick.
And Kill the Boy is what the guy at the wall, Maester Aemon, says to Jon, because he's struggling.
Oh, of
with
course
being,
it is.
Kill,
yes,
kill the boy and let the man be born. It's all like,
that's the one.
Let go of that. That you're not him anymore. You are now the Lord Commander, and you have to. You know.
Gotcha. I loved it actually when they were outside the wall where Brienne and Podrick kind of like just waiting, when they're waiting for a signal from someone to be lit, or they're
waiting there's a candle in the window. Song Elton John almost wrote about that.
Yeah. Candle in the window, amazing.
And that is weird, right? Like, and then the woman in Winterfell gets killed by Ramsay or something.
Yeah, that was it. Was the his kind of like right hand, well, his lover, wasn't it, really, who they were kind of like the Myra Hindley to his Ian Brady kind of character, wasn't it, did he throw her out the window? I think he did, didn't he?
Theon pushes her off the wall at the end of
season.
It's Theon Dobbs in the woman who's trying to help, I think.
Oh shit! Yeah, sorry. I was getting mixed up. So yes, there is. They had an insider, didn't they? Who was going to light the candle?
Like a sort of like a handmaiden or something.
Yeah,
and yeah, but I don't know. I can't remember what was the plan. Like, I'm going to tell you what it's safe. Like what was that candle supposed to communicate, that they could go in? Or I don't understand.
I think that Sansa was waiting for them, maybe, or oh God knows. But yeah, we're still in the midst of Reek and Theon. We have a good scene actually with Reek and Theon a bit in this episode actually. But so all of that happens. Jorah gets infected with grayscale. Then we go on to, then it goes to like Jack and Hagar. This is in episode 6. She sees the chamber full of the faces, which I love that scene. That was great. Yeah, such a great set. Marcella, they find the Sand Snakes attack. Oh God, it's such an awful episode, isn't it? The Sand Snakes attack, the Dornish guards arrest everybody, Jorah and Tyrion are captured by pirates. Is this the one where we got the "but you like the bad pussy" line, the worst line in Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
Worse than the one that Robert Baratheon says, "I bet your fanny smells of strawberries" or whatever he says.
blackberry jam, isn't it?
So come bad. Here, but you smell of blackberry jam.
I hate it. It's so bad. Yeah, I mean, the Sand Snakes kidnap Bronn and Jaime.
Yeah.
But there's a fight. There's a fight, which is, I think, quite a good fight, actually. With Tristan Martell, who Marcel is betrothed to, you know that young lad? He's that Dornish prince.
Yeah.
That's Florence Pugh's brother.
What?
Yeah. The guy that plays Tristan Martell is Florence Pugh's brother. He now is like a musician. He doesn't really do acting.
Blimey. Sliding doors moment for him. Good for him.
I know.
Huh.
Sorry, I distracted you.
No, it's all good. Littlefinger tells Cersei that Roose Bolton intends to marry Sansa to Ramsay, which will mean that Littlefinger's named Warden of the North because he gave Sansa to Ramsay, didn't he? Then there's the whole trial, the inquest thing, where Loras denies his homosexuality, but the male prostitutes Oliver's get a bad rap in Game of Thrones in this season, don't they? Contradicted the testimony.
Ollie.
Yeah, there's Ollie, who fucking stuck them. We find out does the dirty on John. Well, killed Ygritte and then does the dirty on John later on. Sansa weds Ramsay, and then we don't need to. Then there's the
less said about that, the better, I think.
Yeah. Oh my God, we're not even. Then John leaves for Hard Home. Samwell gets his end away.
I forgot about that. I forgot that he made an honest woman out of.
He did. Then we get Jorah and Tyrion kind of like get through all the slaves and whatnot, end up going towards Daenerys.
Yeah.
It's in this one we get the bad pussy. Tyrion Sand gives Bronn the antidote to a poison called the Long Farewell. Prince Doran allows Jamie to take Marcella and her fiancé, Tristan, to King's Landing. We know how that ends. The High Sparrow denies Elena's demands that Loras and Margaery be released. And then Cersei is arrested for her affair with Lancel, which was incestuous because they were cousins. Little did they know. Okay. Then, hope that helped and wasn't too confusing. That was seven episodes of Game of Thrones in about 10 minutes.
It's a lot, isn't it? And I do think, like, even in this episode, there's a feeling of, like, fucking hell, there's a lot going on. Like,
there is a lot going on, but no major events, I guess, apart from Mance dying. No huge things have happened yet. It's all positioning, isn't it?
Even like something like John being elected Lord Commander of the Night's Watch is significant, but it's like actually he's sort of been doing that job unpaid.
We've known it's coming for a while, haven't we?
It also just doesn't really change. He still does all the things that he would do, you know.
And didn't really end up getting much more respect from the Night's Watch anyway, did he?
Exactly. This is the problem, is if you come in as like the you know, technically the far left liberal candidate.
Yeah.
Your constituents are all anti-immigration.
Yeah,
you can't enact the policies you want without literally someone knifing you in the back.
That's a good analogy of the wildling.
I think the wildling stuff is, I find it very interesting as it relates to mass immigration. Like, the wall, some people were just born on the right side of the wall, and I'm not going to get too political about it. Well, but
here we go, a little bit of politics. All right, Starmer, hold your horses.
I'm free for question time. No, but it is interesting because you just, especially this episode, you know, the wildlings and the Night's Watch have been in opposition. And then you have this third element, which is all the undead zombies. And you go, oh, yeah, we actually have way more in common. And it benefits us to band together because those are the real enemies.
Yeah,
in our society, we just don't have an equivalent of the Night King to rally against. It's just
I suppose we don't, do we? We have lots of metaphorical Night Kings.
The first half of the episode is just like, let's check in with all the characters.
Well,
let's get a scene with Sansa. Let's get a scene with
Hamilton. Yeah. Well, to refresh people's memory, we're about to dig into season 5, episode 8 of Game of Thrones, the awesome Hard Home. Well chosen by you, the listener. Here is a little quick recap from our sister podcast previously on, which will get you right up to speed and everything you need. Tyrion and Jorah stand before Daenerys and plead their case as to why they should be allowed to live. Tyrion passionately explains that he has turned his back on his family for good and wishes to serve her. He puts forward a compelling case for becoming an advisor due to his previous experience in politics. Daenerys accepts, but ponders what to do with Jorah after vowing to kill him if he ever returned to her presence. Remember, he betrayed her by originally being a spy for Robert Baratheon. Daenerys spares his life, but exiles him from the city as punishment. Punishments are dished out elsewhere too, as Cersei is visited by Septa Unella, an evil cow who taunts Cersei with water in return for the confession of her sins. Cersei asks to see Tommen instead, but is struck by Septa Unella. Confess! She does not. Arya is honing her acting skills with Jaqen in Braavos. She describes her new persona of Lana, an oyster seller, and describes her typical day-to-day activities and what route she takes while selling, showing how invested she's becoming in her role as a faceless girl. Jaqen informs her that she will take a different route the next day and poison a life insurance salesman to appease the many-faced god. In Winterfell, Theon enters Sansa's chambers and explains why he double-crossed her by telling Ramsay of her escape plan. Sansa asks why he killed her brothers, and he confesses he never actually did it, killing two farm boys instead. Hearing that her brothers might still be alive gives Sansa hope once more. In the Great Hall, Roose is preparing for war against Stannis, going through his battle plan with his advisors. Roose wants to hold back and let the wintry conditions take care of Stannis' army for him, whereas Ramsay insists they attack first. Back at the edges of Meereen, Jorah returns to Yezanzo Kagaz and asks he be allowed to fight in front of Daenerys in the fighting pits in order to prove his loyalty to her. Sam is being treated for his wounds after saving Gilly from the brothers' attack at the wall when Ollie walks in and asks to privately speak with him. Ollie asks how Jon could possibly allow the wildlings through the wall when they've killed so many, including his family. Sam explains that Jon made a really difficult decision, but ultimately the wildlings will be invaluable in the coming war.
At Hardhome, John, Tormund, and a group of the Night's Watch brothers have come to talk to the Lord of Bones, the leader of the Wildlings, to persuade them to return with them to fight. Tormund shows his leadership skills off and kills this Lord of Bones and marches through the baying crowd, demanding the Wildling elders gather for talks. John explains to them how Dragonglass can kill a White Walker, telling them of Sam's success. Reasoning that the fight is not hopeless against the Night King and his army, John asks for numbers to help defend the wall in return for allowing the Wildlings to farm south of the wall. However, John is then asked what happened to Manch Raider, and he has to confess to killing him. This angers the elders, but Tormund assures them that it was out of mercy, not malice. After further talks, the Wildlings agree. As everyone is loading the ships ready to leave, ice begins to roll down the cliffs and mysterious figures appear on the top. The group are attacked by a vast army of wights. A huge battle ensues with John nearly succumbing to a White Walker after losing the Dragonglass in the heat of the battle. The White Walker gets momentarily stunned at being unable to break John's Valyrian steel sword. John quickly realises the Valyrian steel is special and scythes into the White Walker, shattering him into a million pieces. John, Tormund and the giant, 1-1, are among those who narrowly escape the still growing swarm of wights as they clamber onto boats. As they retreat, John sees the Night King emerge and walk to the edge of the pier in utter silence. Never breaking his gaze from John, the Night King strikes a pose and raises the dead on the battlefield as reanimated wights. John's dead comrades are now his undead foes. The army of the dead marches on, and John finally has his proof.
Okay, welcome back. Thank you very much, for that recap. If you want to listen to more of those, go to Previously On. Search for it wherever you get your podcast. There's loads there. Where should we begin? Like you said before we went to Previously On, a lot of setting up the first half of the episode. I think, like, we're starting to see the pattern emerge because we're doing so condensed kind of like flagship episodes so much.
Yeah.
There is a pattern of, like, they set aside maybe 13 minutes per ep for this event, and it really does give this kind of Mandela effect of how you remember these huge episodes like Baelon and Hardhome and Battle of the Bastards and Red Wedding, whereas actually we seem to have the, oh my god, it was just such an amazing episode, it had this and it had that, and they're very clever at, like, leaving the last thing you remember as being the main event.
Yes. Yeah.
The first thing I wrote was, what the fuck is happening? Because I watched this, I was just like, I don't know why.
You get, like, dropped in to, like, all this drama. You're I don't remember the context. Why?
Yeah.
But
I know. But we begin with Tyrion meeting Dany for the first time.
Absolutely. So glad we jumped into this, because Tyrion spends the last 7 episodes getting here, mainly. And this, all this stuff, he has 2 big scenes with Dany this episode, and they're fucking great, aren't they?
Yeah, Peter Dinklage really, really comes into his own when he's away from the rest of the Lannisters.
Yeah.
And he kind of really settles into this brilliant kind of political advisor role, which it just suits him down to the ground. And, you know, I watched this scene, I was just like, he knows exactly what Daenerys is going to end up being like. He can see there's the glimmer of tyranny in Daenerys' words. Even now in this speech, though, we got the whole breaking of the wheel kind of thing going on, didn't we?
And
you could just see that it's a bit like that. Whenever people are like, oh, we just didn't see Daenerys ending up how she ended up, it's like, it was all there. You know,
It is all there. Yeah, it is all there. And you can see it in the way that she conquers Meereen. You can see the way that she, you know, it's sort of trying to rule with adoration, and it's like, well, you haven't actually tried to convince the, you know, the people that can actually get you there.
Yeah.
And Tyrion really deals, I think, you know, she is surrounded mostly by people that either fancy her or that kind of work for her in most of her story, and especially now.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Must be nice. And Tyrion does kind of say to her, like, okay, so who's on your side? No one. Yeah. The Lannisters never are. The Tyrells probably might, but that's not enough.
Yeah.
I thought what was interesting, you know, he didn't talk about the all the other houses. And I do think, like, actually, she does convince the Greyjoys to back her. Mm-hmm. and she does convince the Martells, and they were sort of left out of that speech. And I thought, that's probably just because the quote, the soundbite is very effective with your her speech about the wheel. But he points out that this is a very, very complicated task, and she's not given a great deal of thought into how she's going to do it.
Yeah, because she in her mind it's brute force, it's dragons, it's like, what do I? Yeah. I don't need to speak to anyone. I've got dragons and I've got the Unsullied. Fuck everything. And he's like, well, that's not quite how it works, because you've still got to. That might get you the throne, but it won't keep you on the throne. You know, that's where it's coming from.
All you're going to do is have all these orphans. You're going to orphan a load of people. You're going to make a load of widows, and they're going to grow to resent you, and they're all going to want revenge. And it's like I remember at the time the break the wheel speech. I was like, holy fuck, this is amazing. And I would say, by the end of the show, she doesn't necessarily do it, but the wheel is kind of broken by the end. They have this weird council. They have elections.
It's reset, isn't it? Yeah.
It's reset. And actually, I think I wrote this at the time because I was reviewing the final season for the I paper. John killing Daenerys kind of breaks the wheel, because it stops the idea that one family has an inordinate right to do this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did think, okay, breaking the wheel sounds great, but again, like, how do you think the people in the wheel are going to feel about that? That you need them, you know? But it's great. I love the combination of these characters. It's all written for the show. None of this is in the books yet. I just think it's really well realized. And even that throne room that she has in the pyramid in Meereen is it's such a great set.
They've
used it really cleverly with shooting from different angles. We open with Tyrion sort of shot from under the chin, which makes him look really superior. And he is. He knows a shit ton. So I loved all that. And I love the way that even Daenerys actually, like, she's smart. She's like, what do you think I should do with this guy? Because I don't know what to do with Jorah. Like, tell me what to do with him and I'll think about it. And she kind of gets him banished, right? She kicks him out again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Tyrion's suggestion that he just gets banished rather than getting killed, which was interesting that he didn't just decide just to fuck him off. Because Jorah had... It was Varys that took him over. What happened to Varys at this point? I can't remember how Jorah got Tyrion away from Varys. Were they in a brothel or something? Or no?
I think Tyrion ran away.
Right. Okay. Got you.
And Jorah kidnapped him in a brothel.
That was it. Okay, fine. And Varys obviously ends up there at some point.
I think Varys is still in Pentos at the moment with Illyrio, who's the guy that brokered the wedding with Daenerys and Khal Drogo.
Right. Okay. Christ.
I think he was in one of the episodes this season that we will have missed. But it's funny because Jorah, the last episode we saw, Jorah gets booted out. And then it's like, he just comes, it's like a bad smell. He just comes straight back.
And we see
and he goes again. She gets rid of him again. And then he comes back after getting his grayscale cured.
That's right. Yeah.
It's like,
there's no. That was one of the questions I had, was when we see him a bit later on muscling his way into the kind of dragon pit fight, because then that would... That's just because he fancies Daenerys, isn't it? There's no political allegiance there, or there's no real reason for him to be there. No. He doesn't know of any impending threat, does he? He just wants to be near his bay, doesn't he?
It's the only way he can stay in the city is to fight.
Yeah.
And I think also, there's nothing outside the walls of Meereen, so he would probably just die. So he's kind of like, the only thing I've got is to go in the gladiator style pits.
Right. Okay.
I just find all of that really boring. I find Jorah as the sort of piney kind of.
It's not his best look, is it?
I mean, it's easy for me to say this because, we can all think we know better. But, send that guy as your envoy over to Westeros. Get him to drum up support. I mean, he's literally from a house in the north, like the Mormons. Like, do some... But obviously he's been exiled from there, so they probably don't want to see him. But, yeah, he's a bit of a sad sack at this point, isn't he? He's kind of mopey.
He's a pretty sad sack at most points, really, isn't he?
Yeah, it's true. But I just loved him in the start of Game of Thrones. He was like a really good figure. Like, he knew loads about Westeros and he was telling her things.
True,
and
that's good.
He's just constantly like, oh, have you got my last text? Did you like me?
Maybe he was kind of written this way because when it all starts going a bit wrong for Daenerys, we, the viewer, then start pining for Jorah, because we know that he's always like he's always got her back.
Yeah.
You know? I think, well, we're now season five, as it gets a bit further on, when he gets cured from Grayscale and all of that stuff, we know the end is on its way, and we're all starting to turn our heads towards a big finale, and we're wondering how Jorah is going to die, or if he's going to die, or is he going to die saving Daenerys, which he obviously ends up doing. And he had one of the best death scenes in Game of Thrones, I think.
It's good, he's good, good work.
Very satisfying. But
all of that is really interesting. Yeah. I think the thing that Daenerys hasn't really considered is how are you going to do it, and also you realise watching the show, you're like, God, we've got a lot of ground to cover.
We jump straight from there to a quick check-in with Cersei, who's... I love how they kind of, like, remind you that her hair's nice and long, because they obviously know that they're going to chop it all off. So every scene, her hair's kind of dangling in front of her face.
Get the most of those wigs while you can, because they're not going to be around much longer.
And we meet Queen Septa Una, Hannah Waddingham, friend of the show.
Unrecognisable. I know. Unrecognisable.
Is there a bigger leap in, like, concurrent, like, quality television programs to go from Septa Una to Ted Lasso? It's like cannot
it's
get.
Wild. She has had the glow up of all glow ups. So you know, I think I said this last week. I interviewed her last year.
Yeah.
And she was telling me that even that with Ted Lasso, now when people come up to her, they're like, "Can you say shame to me? Yeah. Can you like?" And I was like, how do people recognize you as the, you know, because even when she'd done that, when she was flying out to do more of Thrones, she said that somebody on the plane, she was like feeding her like baby.
Yeah.
And someone on a long flight was like, are you the Shane Nunn? And she was like, we're in a pitch black plane cabin.
Oh, she's great. And she was such a good sport. I ended up, there was like we did a Game of Thrones marathon viewing at the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square. Before season seven, maybe before the launch of season seven, or maybe before the launch of season eight, and like played every episode concurrently for like 3 days or something like that. And there were about 20 people watched every episode nonstop. And she came and rang a shame bell for us. I invited her down to kickstart it all off, and she walked down the cinema aisle ringing a bell. It was amazing. She was so good. Such good fun.
Incredible. The waterboarding scene that happens to her later in the season, that was very controversial at the time, wasn't it? Because they actually kind of waterboarded her a bit.
Yeah. Was that,
and
that's not
was
the one
really...
That's not where you see the mountain walking, is it? Or it may be.
I must be, yeah. Is it right at the end of the season? But and it's Hannah, like, spoke as she was willing to do it. She said, you know, that's what we needed to do to get the shot, but people reacted to it with a lot of shock, like, hang on, you shouldn't have to do that. This is, we've got, you know, that dragon is not real. It's a tennis ball. You know, people aren't actually disemboweling themselves.
Yeah.
I thought that was, it's really interesting. That already has dated that, just the way that they would not get that now on House of the Dragon.
No, true.
But she's great. And that Cersei stuff, I mean, it's such a change from where we see Cersei. Mm. And, but you can even see, like, even now, she's still like, angry. She's got that fire, like she's gonna fuck shit up when she gets out.
Yeah, there's never a moment there where you think, I mean, she cries when she's like sipping, trying to lick the water off the floor a bit later on, so but there's never a moment where she doesn't think she's gonna get out and fucking destroy all of these people. She's writing her own.
Qyburn visits her to say that Uncle Kevin, which is Tywin's brother, is coming back from Casterly Rock to be for Tommen, and just that further sense that her power's just been taken away, that it was only temporary as a woman, like she was never actually, and everything was just on borrowed time. That Tommen is like not in a good place now that the two only people in his life, both overbearing women, have been taken away from him, and he's not coping.
Tommen was a good Dean played Tommen well, I think, you know.
I think so.
Really, really well. Because there's not much to him. He's a bit of a div, isn't he? And just completely out of his depth and never really given a chance. But, you know, I think Dean played him really well.
He's really good, and I was blown away in season six when he just walks out, walks out of the window.
Great death scene, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Great.
And I think he's so clever because he's such the opposite of Joffrey.
Yeah.
Like, he's actually really malleable and really easy to control, and that meant that, like, Cersei'd lost control of him because someone else is sort of, like, closer to him, like his wife. And then she tries to take out Margaery, not realizing that he is so tethered to his wife that you kill her, you kill him. Yeah. And that's just the greatest sort of tragedy that Cersei doesn't anticipate.
That was amazing.
His loss of function without his wife. Yeah. But I'm really looking forward to seeing some of him because he is interesting in this.
Then we jump over to Braavos and start getting into Arya's story. What do you feel about this part of Arya's journey?
It's one of the few things that I wish I was watching the whole story of, actually, because I sort of forgot a bit about it. I mean, I really hate the woman who is like the Terminator assassin.
Yeah.
That is her like enemy, because I'm just like, why?
Doesn't need to be there.
Yeah,
apart from the showdown.
I think the Faceless Men, for me, the show doesn't really know how much to tell us about it all. And I just feel like we wait all this time for her to get there, and it's, the actual job is actually quite boring. And so it's quite difficult because it's like, oh, you have to just observe people gambling on the docks and the loan sharks. And she is kind of like a low level soprano associate in this, it's like the hired mob, you know, she's kind of like, I like it, but it's funny, isn't it? It's not the most interesting.
I get confused with the semantics of it all and the actual mechanics of what they're doing, because I get that they become this person that's malleable, that where they're actually not, and you know, it's just a way that they kind of carry themselves. But then we literally see the House of Black and White full of different faces, and it's like, are they real? Are they mad? Are they imaginary? Yeah. Are they just in the imagination? How does it work? Do they physically take a head? You know, like, are they Wurzel Gummidge? That's the bit for me. I get bogged down in that kind of shit, and probably too much. But you know, it gets confusing because in some scenes, I think a bit later on, especially when she goes after Meryn Trant, we see a different person, like actual different person.
Yeah.
Yet in this scene where she's observing the oyster with the fish, the guy in the harbour with the oysters, it's just her with her hair tied back. It's just a bit of a weird inconsistency, I think, in terms of, like you say, confused about what it is they actually do, you know?
And I think,
are they magic or are they just kind of like good persuaders? I don't. It's just weird.
I think from my understanding, it is a combination of the two.
Right.
I can't remember much about it, but I think the problem as well with what we see them do in the show, which is physically putting someone's face on, there's not really a way of making that not look shit. And I think, like, when Arya is like, if she pulls off like a handkerchief.
Have you not seen the Mission Impossible franchise? Come on.
Yes, but that's different. This, you know, that's sort of hyper realistic and it's just silly, isn't it? But I think, like, this show, you know, the way that they've done it, or the way that they go on to do it, because I think at this point Arya's not worn a disguise, because when she takes one, is that not when they take her eyes away from her?
Oh yes, she might.
Later in the
so
season.
This is just like this. Is,
so I think she uses a face that she's not supposed to, but I think initially, isn't it
because she's asked to kill the woman who's doing that panto? Or she's,
that's it. Yeah, that is season six.
Right.
She has to kill someone doing the play within the play.
She chooses not to.
And she adopts the name Mercy, which is again like symbolism overload, right? Like, she can't lose herself in this faceless guild. Her identity is too. She doesn't want to lose needles. She doesn't want to give away
these
things.
Yeah.
I think the stuff in Braavos is really interesting. I just think she spent a long time getting there, and then it is over before it's done. But yeah, the sort of, I love the idea. I mean, Maisie Williams is actually really good at just becoming other people. And she does become this sort of Cockney whelk slinger quite well. Yeah. And every season she's sort of pretending to be someone else. And I find that really fascinating to have watched in our rewatches. Yeah. But I just would love to know more. I mean, you sometimes in these scenes, you're like, sorry, is there only three of you that work here? And one of you came here by happen chance. They're like, thank fuck you turned up randomly. We have no staff.
We've got all these jobs lined but up. All these like chef's tickets hanging off the thing. Yeah. These orders. And we've, yeah.
But the other thing about it that's kind of a bit hard to get your head around is that it is sort of seen as this mystic guild, but they are like paid assassins.
Hold your horses just for a second there, young Mandel. We're going to get a quick word from our sponsors. Back in a tick.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
I think religion is sort of quite a big part in the show. We've obviously got the Faith of the Seven, the old gods, but then we've also got the Red God. The faceless men follow the God of Death. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of interesting belief systems, and I think I like having that in the show. I like the idea that everyone is just kind of has blind faith in these systems, even though, as we've shown, like Melisandre can do all the magic she wants, but she like can't make things happen if they don't happen.
She still kind of goes, God moves in mysterious ways, you know. It's like,
yeah, she's like, Stannis is the one true king, and then she's like, maybe the flames lied. It's like, you're being gaslit by flames.
Gaslit by your god. Like, yeah, your god's just making it up.
She's like, oh, maybe. But the thing is also, I suppose in Westeros a lot of the men do sort of look the same, don't they? So if she's like, oh, I see like a haggard man with lots of facial hair
wearing
and old
fur
cloak,
with a
like,
beard, it's
yeah. Melisandre, that could be anyone.
Okay, then, oh my goodness me. There's the great scene with Sansa and Theon, which I thought was really good.
Yeah.
So Sansa's obviously not in a great place. Neither's Theon, it has to be said. And it's the scene where we get the big reveal that that Theon reveals to Sansa that Bran and Rickon aren't dead, as far as he knows. You know, because up until this point, Sansa had been told that Bran and Rickon were burnt at Winterfell, and that it was Theon that did that. But as we always knew as viewers, that wasn't the case. He'd done it to two farm boys. I really like. I think Alfie Allen did a really good job as Theon and Reek. I think, and he, you know, by the end, he was a hero. He's one of my favourites, Theon was, towards the end. And there's a really good bit in this where you can see his resolve is wavering. You can see it in the lines he said, but he gets mixed up in terms of how he's talking about himself in the third person.
Yeah, he does,
He talks Theon in the third person, because he's Reek, but then he gets towards the end of it, I think it actually switches. And it's like a subtle shift in his psyche, I think was really quite cleverly done there. But I love his kind of his comeback.
And I think like there's a sense, I got the impression, obviously we are coming into this a little bit blind because we've not seen Sansa all season. We've not watched any of it, but this seems to be the point where she sees a bit of hope. Because her siblings are alive somewhere, there's like a, okay, so someone else has actually got a better claim to the North than Ramsay. I have to sort of stay strong. I have to stay alive and try and see this through. And I think it is, the odds are just impossible at this point because Ramsay and Roos are sort of ruling. Yeah.
They're steamrolling through Westeros, aren't they? Then
Yeah, and it's and she's got no, you know, I think actually the thing with the woman in the window, Theon was like, I can get you help. But no, the woman is like, the North remembers. Do you remember? She was like, I'll get you out. I've got someone on the outside. And then Theon dobs the woman in. So that's why Sansa's like, how the fuck, you got my hopes up and you dashed them. But she kind of breaks him a little bit. He breaks the reek and thing.
So Sansa and Arya are kind of like on the travels and stuff like that. Do they just assume? I think they do. They know that John's gone to be a member of the Night's Watch. So in their mind, they've just written him off because he's now given up all kind of association with them. Blah 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 blah. So they know he's still alive. Yeah. They're just kind of like, well, there's no point in even trying.
Yeah, and he's a bastard.
And he's a bastard.
And so the only person that can legitimize a bastard is like a king or like a warden. Yeah. And no one is going to do that. The only people that can do that were the ones that would stand to lose out from him doing that. But also, he can't even leave the wall. You know, in theory, you get your head chopped off and you leave. So they've sort of written him off. And I think there's probably part of them that is like, well, he's not really a Stark.
They soon change their ways.
Oh, mate, they soon change their tune when it suits them. Oh, yeah, we were always big fans of you.
Remember I was the only one that got you that Christmas present?
Yeah.
Why was Sam bruised? Did he get kicked in the episode before? I was a bit confused.
Did he defend Gilly from some...
Oh, so he defended her and then they... Oh, yes, and then they had sex.
And then they had sex.
Because he was like, all out. She was like, oh, you're all right. And he was like, no, please. Yeah. It's just a cut. Carry on shagging me. Don't stop. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He said, don't stop. We've talked about this before, but fucking hell. Like, I find him so boring.
Who's Sam?
And the Sam and Gilly stuff, it's just like, oh, God, did we need that scene? I know that Ollie has to be seen to be of animosity towards the wildlings, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that was there purely for Ollie to have his monologue about why he's going to end up, why he was building up his resentment for John. But I just think in general, Sam and Gilly, they're a bit of light relief. They're a bit of kind of like a reminder that, you know, in war, there were still women that put gravy browning on, you know, drew lines on the back of their legs to have a shag with an American soldier. You know, life and love kind of still go on even in the trenches. I think that's what I took from that story, is that even in the
you've got it.
And because neither of them had anything, they discovered each other and it gave them both something to live for. And it gave, and I think with Samwell, he knew how useless he was. He knew that he was kind of like just banished from his family, just the Tarlys, just through shame of his size or his ineptitude at kind of battle or whatever. And Gilly gave him hope and made him kind of like feel like a bit of a man and kind of like and encouraged, you know, the whole kind of like, you mean you read all these from words in paper? You know, it's kind of like, oh, that's my that's my strength, you know. And then that's why he then I think spurs him on to go and try and be a maester, you know, with his relationship with Aemond.
And she's also like, she's seen some shit. Mm. Like, you know, all the noble ladies that he'd have been paired with, they'd just like sew and like eat cakes and sort of pick flowers. And he's got this like sort of savage woman from north of the wall who's literally seen like
her incestuous son after him. What more of a honour can someone bestow?
Well, my theory was that she's actually doesn't know any of the boy names because she knows Craster, who's her dad, uncle, brother. And then every other child that is a boy is fed to the White Walkers. So she goes, I don't know any other names.
It's just a limited
imagination.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. But no, I, you know, it's nice to have them to root for. I just, a lot of, what I'd like is for them to go to a vastly different location so that they don't have to just film in these cold, windowless
cold
rooms.
Cold trenches and hide in kitchens all the time. Yeah.
Maybe they could both go to Dawn or something.
Yeah, sunshine.
You know, get the factor 30 on.
There was a good...
What's that big glowing thing in the sky? It's making my skin hurt.
I best get my bikini wax on. There was a good line at the end of that scene with Ollie and Sam, though, which was a bit of foreshadowing, where Sam just laughed and he said, John always comes back. which
in more ways than one.
And then we head into Hardhome. So actually, it was longer than 13 minutes. It was nearer kind of.
It's like 20 nearer, minutes, yeah, wasn't it? Like 20 half the episode.
Include all of the preamble. I love the color grading of this whole section.
It looked,
it was just shout out Miguel Sapochnik directed this, and like when I interviewed him for House of the Dragon, he was kind of very keen to kind of reiterate that he didn't just kind of like direct battle episodes. But it's like, I get it. But you were so why not play down the fact that you're a fucking master at these incredible set pieces? And I'd forgotten actually how scary this is. And it's like it plays out like a horror movie, rather than a battle. Yeah, there's a big battle going on, and all the usual kind of Game of Thrones tropes are there that make it so great. But the best bits are the creepy. It's just creepy. The silhouettes of the horses on top of the cliff. The White Walker walking through the flames. You know, loved it. It's a little bit, you know, Steven Spielberg. It's like when you're waiting for the T-Rex to arrive in Jurassic Park. It's the ripples on the glass of water.
Yeah, I thought the pacing of it was really interesting because I remember this battle. I remember it being gigantic, but actually they dial the pressure, and it's like that thing of the frog being boiled alive. It starts off and it's just on the docks and there's all this kind of fighting. And then there's the people coming to the gates. They block the gates. Then the gates are breached. And then by the end, all of the dead are resurrected. And you're like, God, we've just created like what? Like 8,000 more undead soldiers? Yeah, yeah. At least, I don't know how many people are.
Well, they said they got.
It must be loads.
They said they
got.
There was a moment where they said they'd got 5,000 off the island. 5,000 onto the boats, and John.
Yeah, because it's like
John just said that's not enough, you know. And so I think the impression was there were like maybe 20,000 people there or something like that. There were a lot.
So we talked about Hardhome a little bit last week. We were wondering how Stannis got the forest, and I said he must have come via Hardhome. That is actually incorrect, because Hardhome is further north, and it's like a peninsula, like a little apostrophe shape, and it is like a fishing village. And so actually the wildlings would actually trade with people that were coming from all around.
Okay, so that's how they get their goods. Okay,
so that's how they get their goods, and they do a good trade and that sort of thing. And they'll get pelts and they'll get basic tools and things like that. So they sort of row a boat around the wall and go to Hardhome that way, and then they'll row back.
Okay, right, yeah.
They'll row to a big ship, and then the ship will go, And Eastwatch, where they would have probably come to and from, is the castle on the furthest east, and that's where Janos Slynt was going to get sent to go.
That's right.
And John was going to task loads of people with looking after and repairing some of the old castles. And he was like, I'm not going to go and do that. So he chopped his head off. But I just loved, I thought the way it escalated was really slow and steady. And even the Carsey, who is the lady, wildling.
When this episode first came out, I was like, oh my God, it's da 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 da. Because she'd just been in. Like a really kind of...
Wasn't it Borgen?
Is it Borgen? Yes, it is Borgen, isn't it?
I thought that was the one she was in. And then...
Yeah, Bridget Sorensen. Yeah, she played Katrine.
Yes.
With Pilau Asbeck, who that was his...
That was his who we'll then see in season 6. And then, of course, she went on to star in Pitch Perfect 3. That's one of those things where you book Game of Thrones and suddenly it's like, I can get you a part in Pitch Perfect 3 as the Scandinavian show choir leader. She did.
Okay, I thought maybe it was Game of Thrones. Yeah.
Isn't that wild? So I thought this was really interesting because, I don't know if Thrones does this so much, or this is probably the most effective version of it, where they introduce a character. The character goes through like quite a significant transformation. And then we're never going to see her again. She gets killed, right? She starts off hostile to John and the wildlings, like and Tormund. She comes around. She goes, "I'm going to do this for Tormund. You're a wildling as well. she comes around to John's side of the situation, and then she dies. And it's really good. That really good through line. It's a good character.
They have to have these characters in these moments, because the reality of... Because what it does is it condenses a process very, very quickly that in real terms would have been like, well, we've got to put this to vote. We need to go and ask the 20,000 people if we're going to kind of like go with Tormund, you know, or we're going to do this. This actually goes, she's displaying the kind of the apprehension of all of these people, and the argument's taking place here, and she's changed her mind. Therefore, from a viewer's point of view, you go, okay, it's all fine. They're with her now, and it's never spoken. Yeah, exactly. You know, there are millions of other people that just go, we agree.
Everyone
fine, okay,
line,
I wasn't aware.
Like,
yeah, exactly. So that's that, and they have these quite a lot in these kind of episodes where they need to have. They need to be able to just like turn the plot very, very quickly without
start the conflict, end the conflict, move forward.
But I remember everyone assuming that. Do you remember there was that bit where we were like, oh my god, they're all going to appear at the end as the undead?
Yeah.
Like we're going to see all of these people again. Are we going to see blah 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 blah? Blah blah blah. It's like we're all quite looking forward to it. We didn't in the end.
That would have been pretty cool, actually. All the people.
Yeah, a bit of a nice callback.
There's also a great bit in this hard home sequence that I love, which is when the giant bursts out of the hut. Because, again, it's very Spielberg-y. The scale of
now,
it
this is Yun Yun.
Yes,
this is Yun
Yun. We were asking about we couldn't tell our giants apart last week. We know he's in the hut because we see this shot of him looking up, and then he kind of just... Yeah, the whole hut just sort of falls apart around him. It's really amazing. My only question was, how was the giant going to get away? Because surely he would sink the boat if he got on the boat.
It's never really explained, is it? Maybe
he starts wading through the water, and it's like, mate, I hope you can swim.
Maybe he just hangs on the back and just maybe like paddles. He uses it as like a float, you know, like we do.
Yeah, like World's Strongest Man, just got the rope in his teeth, and he's just sort of like going away at the front. That was great, though. He has that big flaming log swinging it around, like whacking all the
I love the giants. They did giants really, really well. Just mainly because they weren't CGI. They were just actual blokes in prosthetics.
Right, right.
In fact, you know, I'll put it up on maybe in the show notes. I'll put up there's a great photo of me with Yun Yun's hand on. It's great. So good.
Wow.
It was massive. Like, because I think the guy that played him was like 7'6" or something.
Do they get those like basketball player looking guys that are
foot eight? Like huge kind of guy to play him. But even then, the hand, I think I put it on and the hand was just like, but you could move, but it was so nimble. It was so light. I could give myself, I think there's one of me giving myself the finger with it. It was brilliant. Not literally, but it was.
No, I was going to say that would really hurt.
There was a moment, and actually maybe this is from the books, there was a quote where someone said, where they were talking about the White Walkers and the threat from beyond the wall, and someone said, oh, they've got ice spiders as big as horses.
Yeah, that's a book
now,
thing.
Are they monsters from the book? They are, aren't they? They're Do you see them at all?
I don't think they go in the show. I don't think we see them. But in the book, it's told that they ride these giant ice spiders.
Right,
huge, like, and you know, they have like mammoths and all kinds of just, and there's just a sense, I think, they are in control of, there's just so much more to them that we just don't really get a sense of. But I think they probably thought it would look a little bit Harry Potter.
That's true, because, there was all wasn't there,
and again, it's a line in the book, and I think when the show gets to it, they're like, so do they have webs? Are the webs frozen? Why would that benefit? Is it going to get a bit Peter Parker? Like, so it just gets easier to just not really deal with it. But this all happens in the books off page, in that John is not there. He just hears that, like, he tries to rescue loads of people that are trapped there.
Right.
And it just, he sends people to go and take care of them, and it goes really badly.
Okay.
And
also, there isn't
some people come
there
back.
Isn't that moment between the Night King and
no.
John.
No, isn't really a Night King in the same way. No. It's all very opaque, very sort of hard to know what's going on beyond the wall, because we just haven't really been there. So whenever they do scenes like the Night King getting that baby and turning it into a a White Walker. Like, that's all for the show.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, oh, okay, like, how much do you know about what's George told you? What does this mean? You know, where is this?
Yeah. But also...
You need to have him.
You need a baddie. There needs to be a singular baddie, you know.
And I even think that, like, the show does get to the White Walker stuff now. It's sort of, but it still takes so long. It's two more seasons before Daenerys sort of gets on board with it. And you're like,
yeah,
I get it. You've got a lot to adapt. You've not got the tools to sort of do this really seamlessly. But, like, it does feel like even now when we're getting a lot of information, we're still like, so can they speak? What's the deal? What do they want?
Yeah.
Why can they walk through fire? Like, it's quite confusing, isn't it?
It is. And we never really... not in the show anyway ever really found out. It'd be interesting, you know, obviously this is coming towards the end of the source material anyway. It'd be interesting to know if we ever eventually find out whether, you know, because the whole, I think the Night King exists because it's a bit of a trope, a bit of a drama trope of like, it's like a game, computer game thing where if you kill the boss, then all of the other ones die too.
Because
otherwise, there was no real easy way of the writers of the TV show for ending this threat. You know, there was no way because of the sheer scale of the undead, of the White Walkers. You know, there would have been no way that they could have fought it out. There had to be like a pass. There had to be a free pass somewhere, and that was
a safety cut out. You know, if you cut this wire, then everything's
exactly that. That's what it is. So it'd be interesting to see how they deal with that in the books.
I think this is the first episode that we see Valyrian steel kill a White Walker.
Yeah,
we've seen Dragonglass.
Yeah,
I think John is like quite shocked that the guy.
It's a great.
It was like a big sewing needle. That's his sort of sword, isn't it? It's just like a big knitting needle. Did you see it?
Yeah, I've held that. The big, the White Walker's kind of spear.
It's like a spear sword
made out of
thing.
Like clear. It's made out of clear resin. It's wobbly. It's really good. It's great. But yeah,
oh, really.
Yeah, yeah. But there's Kit Harington actually acted his little socks off in this episode. He does really good eye acting in this. Where he's standing on the boat at the end, just looking absolutely fucked. And he's just like, he looks terrified. And he's just like the shock of what he sees. But yeah, there's a great almost Indiana Jones moment, isn't there? Where he's fighting the White Walker and there's that clang of metal on metal where it's just like, oh,
you've
not destroyed my sword. And even the White Walker was like, what the fuck? Yeah.
Yeah, the White Walker's like, this has never happened before. Yeah. And just a lot of like rolling around, like even when he gets punted in the chest by the guy, you really feel he can't get back up and the sword's out of reach, but again, like, it's, you just have to go, okay, I guess Valyrian steel kills them. I mean, because they don't really, there's not enough swords out there, no one's kind of like, oh well, I'm the expert on this and this is how it works. It just, you just go, okay,
I guess. When would the last time have been that they'd have realized that? I mean, it would have been House of the Dragon kind of era, wouldn't it? Well, no, actually, they wouldn't have known because they didn't really know about the White Walkers then.
Exactly. Valyrian steel is kind of, I think, it's forged. The sword is forged with dragonfire. It's like it contains all the magic that is in dragonfire.
Yes.
And it's fused into a sword. And that's kind of the same as dragonglass. It's just dragonglass is a bit more...
It's not formed
in nature rather than formed by men.
It's not a stretch to assume that the two are kind of interlinked, is it? Yeah.
But then when we see Daenerys brings the dragons to take on the White Walkers and she breathes fire on them and they're like, no, I'm fine. I'm still fine.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, okay.
Okay, that's not allowed.
I don't understand. But
can the dragons breathe on some sand and make it into glass first?
Yeah, could we just, let's all set up a little tool station just outside Winterfell and we'll set this up. But this is the thing, is I think that like all throughout the show, you're kind of going, so Daenerys has dragons, they've got fire, she's going to go north, and that's going to be how it wins.
Yeah.
And so you get ready, and then the show goes, actually that doesn't work. And you're like, okay, this is quite frustrating to try and follow along.
Yeah.
I love organization. I love a rule as a general.
Yeah,
that's why I like cleaning the flat so much.
Yeah.
And so when you get like a sense of like, here's the system, and then the show sort of goes, no, I think it... that is when the latter part of the show did get quite frustrating. Because and, you know, like, there's no reason this shouldn't work.
And you know, and there's a reason, you know, the Night King, as we learn later on, is really fucking handy with the spear. He could have just killed Jon.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if he can throw that 200 foot in the air to kill a dragon, I reckon he could have probably taken Jon out.
I did wonder a couple of times. I mean, obviously, the short answer is because if Jon gets killed, the whole thing is a lot less interesting. Yeah. But he sort of punched him at one point, and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
It's not Tekken. Like, what? You don't have to, like, save your good moves until the end. Yeah. You know, you can just... But anyway, but I think Hard Home is a really successful episode.
Yeah.
Because you leave feeling worse than when you started. You're like, oh, this is really bad.
Well, it was the first time that we'd really been shown the scale and threat of the Night King and the White Walkers. It was, you know,
absolutely.
And also, obviously, it was the first time that a principal cast member, Samwell aside, had seen them and had gone, right, holy shit, this is the problem. This is, you know, and it changes Jon completely, because from now on in, he's all like, fuck all this. This is nothing compared to what I've seen. You know, and it takes him a long time to persuade them that, but...
My favourite bit, actually, one of my highlights of this episode is when he tells the wildlings, he's like, so we know for a fact that Dragonglass does kill them. Yeah. And one of the guys goes, did you see this happen? And he goes, no, a friend told me it happened, but I believe him. Yeah. And they're like, what the fuck? Yeah. We've got no clue.
Yeah.
But it does put everything, that vows of the Night's Watch, the fighting over the throne, the power, the grain reserves and Highgarden, and it all puts it into, like, perspective, like, why the fuck are we fighting about it?
And
the religious zealots and all that, it's like,
just doesn't matter.
On.
There's an apocalypse on the way. Question, is the Night King's pose, the big, where he raises his arms, is that the most iconic scene in Game of Thrones?
I think it's the most memed, definitely.
Yeah.
Of the, like, come at me, bro. Like,
What would your
you want a piece? Like,
what would if you were having to present to the class as well? What would you bring to the table as your most iconic scene
in
the whole of the season? Like, if you were at meme school and and you saw that the guy
that's a good question,
and you saw that the guy coming after you had the Night King already there. Like the come at me bro meme ready to go. And you were like,
oh my God, doesn't know this. I have a good answer for this. I was doing this as a bit for quite a while in 2019, but there's a really good scene of Varys.
Yeah.
I think it's in the final season, sort of gagging and sort of like almost looking like spitting something out. And anytime there was some like bullshit about like new rumors about David Cameron fucking a pig, I'd be doing Varys going like, I did that for quite a long time. And I'd even be like, if someone I worked for had like not paid an invoice for a month, I'd be like, me when HR says they need a new PO order, I'm like,
That's a good one.
That would be mine.
Okay.
What would be yours?
I don't know. I asked you this question without having even thought about it myself. I do like the it's not like an iconic one, but the one that's now been paired with Chris Hemsworth from Thor, Daenerys doing where she's with Cersei, where she's like, is it though? Yeah, or that kind of.
She's like, narrow, her eyes are so narrow. She's like, really?
Really? Yeah.
The one I hate is Ramsay wiggling the sausage.
Yeah.
That's done quite often. Yeah. And I'm like, I hated that. Like, we get it. You castrated someone.
Yeah.
Grow up.
Grow up, for goodness sake. There we go. And we ended on silence as well, which is always a signifier of a Game of Thrones moment. That was Hard Home, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening. I enjoyed that. That felt like a good one to kind of like come back at and
really
cover
good
a lot of ground there. Next week, we're going concurrently straight after this. It's episode 9, which is called, oh my God,
The Dance of Dragons.
The Dance of Dragons. Okay, fab. Oh, yes. Oh, I like this one. Perfect. This is so we get to see Daenerys.
I think it'll be a really good one because there's quite a lot of people in it. Whereas I do think, like, this episode, I loved it, but we didn't get much time to anyone.
That's true.
So I'm looking forward to just checking in with everybody a bit. Also, our friend Meryn Trant is in this next episode.
Oh, love a bit of Meryn. Love a bit of merit.
And I love that storyline because I do think the Arya thing, like, you know, the faceless woman stuff is really confusing. And it's like she actually sees someone that she can cross off the list. And it's like,
yep,
that's something that she's so, like, passionate about. That doesn't she sort of pretend, because isn't he into, like, children?
She pretends to be like a young boy, doesn't she? He's into young men, isn't he? I think.
Yeah. Do you remember when Ian was on the podcast and he, like, wouldn't talk about it?
Yeah, he didn't like. He didn't like one of his.
He was like, "No, I don't want to talk about this, please."
Yeah. Funnily enough,
but it was so good, great episode, yeah. And I'm looking forward to doing three in a row. I mean, that's never happened before.
Well, did we do three in a row last season? Didn't we? Oh no, we did two in a row. We did. It was the first.
No, we did two.
The first concurrent
we did two
last season, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right.
2, 9, and 10. I think last season. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Never a chore. We'll be back later on in the week with the OA, I promise. Sorry about that. And until then, get in touch. Let us know what you thought. As ever, leave us a comment on the YouTube or at @dragoncast_pod on Twitter. We do read everything. Or you can email dragoncast@daftdoris.com and we will get back to you. Thank you so much, Chris. See you next time.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Dracarys!
If you'd like to get involved in the podcast, just head over to Twitter @dragoncast_pod or email dragoncast@daftdoris.com and leave us your Easter eggs, predictions and thoughts on the show. You can also watch this episode over on our YouTube channel. Just search for Dragoncast Janie East. Any support, whether it's a follow, a share, a mention to your friend on the bus or a tattoo on your backside, is very much appreciated. Dragoncast is hosted by me, Jamie East, along with Chris Mandel, and is a Daft Doris production. Dracarys.